Call volume up, population down, rural EMS, we need you, and gun-toting medics. Plus, we're going to take a look at atrial fibrillation. If that's what you're looking for, it's right here on this week's episode of the Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and as always, I'd like to welcome you to this week's program. We have some great stuff coming up, including some interesting articles in this week's news items. But before that, I do want to remind you to head over and check out the main website of the MedicCast, and that's available for you over at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find links to all the articles for news items, as well as additional resource links for any tip segments and or contact information for any interviewees we have on the show. And all of that you can find there on the website, right there at the top of the page, under the heading Show Notes. Just click that link and it'll take you right to the first of the show notes pages. And you can scroll down and go back in time to find all of the episodes, all the way back to episode 1 of the MedicCast. There's going to be some more contact information for me coming up later in the show, but I do want to remind you, if you hear anything in here, you want to get in touch with me, you have a comment, you want to rant, you can catch me by email at podmedic@mac.com, and I will get back to you within 24 hours or so. So if you have a comment, a question, a suggestion, you have a news link you want to send me, any of those you can send in via the MedicCast by sending me that email over at podmedic@mac.com. That's it. We'll get into the news in just a sec. Starting off this week's news items is an article I found out of Springfield, Ohio, and it's from the Springfield News Sun. This particular newspaper is looking at a curious, at least curious to them, concept whereby their population has decreased in the city of Springfield, Ohio by 4,700 residents, according to the most recent census data in the last 10 years. And yet their call volume for their EMS and ambulance calls has gone up. What is the cause of that? And I think that interestingly enough, this is something that is being questioned by a lot of agencies and organizations around the country. And I think that this is something you're going to find seeing going up as well. And it has to do, I think, with the aging of the population. The average age of the population has increased. So even in an area where you may have lost residents, people moved away, people decided to do something else with their lives, or they just flat out died, it does not matter because the average age of the population in your area has probably increased. And as those people, remaining people in your population have increased in age, they have also increased in the numbers of chronic illnesses they're dealing with and the number of cardiovascular disease cases that you're going to see. And this is part of that whole concept of an aging population putting additional strain on medical resources. Now, I'm sure there's some things that have to do with perhaps something to do with increased use of EMS when patients don't have other healthcare resources, such as the uninsured. So that may have something to do with it. But they're looking at this. They don't have really an answer, but they're looking at the data and they're scratching their heads because, of course, at a time like this when agencies are looking for ways to cut back, to save dollars, municipalities are looking for ways to reduce the amount of expenditures and having to cut back services, when you have an increased amount of call volume, cutting back services isn't always something you're able to do. So I wonder what's going on in your area. Are you a supervisor or are you aware of something like this being looked at in your area? And what are the causes that you seem to have identified? I'd love to hear back from you. So please send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com and let's get a little bit of a dialogue going. Perhaps we can report back on this from some of you in a future episode. Meanwhile, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, call volume is increasing, but the volunteers that they have available to run their volunteer ambulance service is going down. Those numbers are going down for them. And why are these numbers decreasing? They look at this particular article I found in the Kiloland.com website. They're looking at reasons why people are not volunteering as much. And they're looking at the amount of training they have to receive. They're looking at just having busier lives. And so they're putting out a call to say, look, you know, if we have to close the doors, if we have to cease ambulance service or only provide part-time ambulance service, the nearest place that we're going to get service is over a half an hour away. So if you call for an ambulance, you're going to have to wait for at least a half an hour to get that ambulance. Whereas if we had our local community servicing an ambulance with rural volunteers, we could find a way to continue to provide services 24/7. So these types of articles are all over the place, and it's also a good example of how you can publicize and provide information to your community about what it is that your EMS service does, how it operates. Is it volunteer? Is it paid? Is it a combination, a hybrid of volunteer and paid? You know, volunteer in the evening and paid during the workday. That happens a lot in my area. So I'm curious to see if there's something like this that you're doing. But, you know, I always talk about that sometimes some of the biggest problems we have with getting funding, with our public being upset with us, often has to do with them not understanding exactly how we operate and not understanding some of the constraints under which we operate and some of the overarching problems we deal with every single day. So again, by publicizing this, by going out and saying, hey, local newspaper, hey, local TV or radio station, could we come on the show and talk a little bit about how we operate and talk a little bit about what we need from our public? You know, people listen to that kind of stuff and they love to know, hey, when I call 911, this is what I can expect. And when someone shows up at my door, this is what I can expect. And this is what I should have ready for them. Or this is what I should be prepared to do when an emergency crops up, that we just can't always be there. You know, last week we talked about the ambulance lag in response during the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shootings. And talking about that article, I think, was based upon public expectation not actually matching up to the realities of calling mutual aid for a mass casualty incident. And this is, again, just a situation where we can educate our public. So I hope that you'll take advantage of that and educate the people that you come in contact with through the variety of channels. Perhaps you do it on a website, on your Facebook page, or through Twitter or whatever. There are ways to reach out and make sure our public knows a little bit more about how we operate. Finally, I just have a question for you. How many of you out there carry a gun when you go to work? It's unusual. I don't know of any EMS providers around my area that actually carry a firearm at work, although maybe they are and I just don't know it or not aware of it. But in Cape Town, South Africa, they're looking at their emergency medical services in the Western Cape region, and they're looking at the country's 100,000 paramedics, saying that many of them carry guns, firearms, to work when they're out and about. Now, they're saying this is not a good reason, it's not something that is a good idea, and that even though their job is a dangerous one, carrying a gun, according to this article, is asking for more trouble. That if perhaps somebody knows there's a gun available somewhere on the unit, maybe not on your person, they might be more likely to attack the paramedics. And yeah, you could say, well, if I had a gun, I could protect myself. But the fact of the matter is that doesn't always work out in the way you intended it. People are notoriously bad shots in high risk and tense situations. Even the most trained individuals have to be really calm and collected even during the most aggressive situations to be able to get that shot off in an aimed fashion. So if you're with your partner and family members and a patient and you have somebody attack your unit, are you going to be able to make sure you don't shoot any of those bystanders? And then I think this is what they're saying in this. But, you know, I'm interested to hear back from you and not just the people who are crazy gun-toting, you know, I have 7 guns when I go to work. But just, you know, average guys, is there anybody out there just thought about carrying a firearm to work with them? This is something that I'd be interested to hear back from you about. So again, that email address is podmedic@mac.com. And you can even check in with me if you are a crazy 7 gun toting paramedic. I'd love to hear from you. Coming up next here on the Medicast, we're going to jump in and revisit a segment and tip we've done in the past, but heck, over 6 years, it's time to revisit some of these things. And we're going to take a look at atrial fibrillation. Now, those of you that are EMTs and basically in basic training, don't just sit there and let your eyes glass over. I think it's important for EMTBs to be aware of what their paramedics and medics are doing. And I think that it's important for you to have a handle on what's going on with the patient. And a little bit of more education never hurts. So I don't get too deep into some of the stuff here. I'm just covering the highlights over the next 10 to 15 minutes. And I hope you all will stick with me as we look at atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is we're going to look at reviewing conduction anatomy and physiology, specifically of AFib, look at some of the causes, risk factors, and some of the side effects associated with AFib, and we'll also look at some of the specific treatments that we might use depending on what's going on with the patient. And that's very important to keep in mind, and we'll talk more about that later. Let's review cardiac conduction. Remember, we have the SA node, the sinoatrial node, and that is the primary pacemaker for the heart. Normal sinus rhythm originates here, and it usually has a rate between 60 and 100 beats per minute. Sometimes, if the atria get a little overexcited, we can have atrial tachycardias, and one of which is atrial fibrillation, and this is a problem where these conduction pathways you see that are heading out into the atria will then be severed because of damage to the heart muscle caused by an MI in the past or just cardiovascular disease causing ischemia, and that over time these pathways become damaged and parts of the atria begin acting on their own, not paying any attention to the sinoatrial node. Normally, though, conduction flows from the sinoatrial node through the atria, through these cardiac conduction pathways, down to the AV node, the atrioventricular node. Here, it's paused for a second to allow that complete atrial squeeze down into the ventricles, expanding the ventricles, filling them with blood, overfilling them, really, and allowing them to stretch a little bit. And it's that stretch that allows the cardiac muscle to even squeeze harder. And so we get a really good ejection of blood from the ventricles because of the atrial preload that occurs. It flows down through the bundle of His, the cardiac conduction, down to the bundle branches, and then out into the Purkinje fibers. And this allows a coordinated squeeze of the ventricles from the bottom to the top and out the pulmonary artery in the case of the right ventricle and the aorta, and out into the systemic circulation in the case of the left ventricle. So specifically, atrial conduction is flowing from the SA node out into these pathways. And if these pathways become damaged, we could have some alternate and aberrant occurrences of conduction occur because different parts of the heart muscle, remember, have their own automaticity, their own ability to generate and start a contraction. And if enough different places, multifocal locations, start causing contractions at the same time, we have no coordination. So let's look at how blood flows through the heart, because this is going to be important when we think about atrial fibrillation too. Remember, blood comes in from the superior and inferior vena cavas on the venous side of the system and enters into the right atrium. From the right atrium, blood is pumped down into the right ventricle and then out into the pulmonary artery and into the lungs to be oxygenated. That oxygenated blood returns via the pulmonary veins to the heart and the left atrium. And then that is pumped down into the left ventricle and then out to the systemic blood supply. So the atrium have the ability to really provide that extra squeeze and give us good cardiac output because of the preload that they cause. They don't have to cause that preload. In other words, we could live with a two-chambered heart. We just wouldn't be very effective at it. We would be suffering from low blood pressure. We wouldn't be able to exert ourselves very much because we really rely on the preload of the of the left and right ventricle that stretches that stronger heart, bigger heart muscle out, and that thicker heart muscle then contracts very much more forcefully when it's stretched and overfilled like that, and it allows for better ejection of blood. So what is AFib? Well, remember when I said there is those aberrant pathways? AFib is when the cells in the atria contract in an independent and uncoordinated manner. So if enough of these cardiac conduction pathways are damaged because of ischemia, cardiovascular disease, then eventually these cells could start coming up with their own idea, and everybody throws their own party, and instead of having a coordinated squeeze that starts at one end and squeezes down into the ventricles, we end up with a quivering bowl of jello. And that's what you can think about. Instead of that like coordinated rolling squeeze, kind of like the wave going around a stadium, we end up with everybody just standing up and screaming their heads off and waving their arms around. And it makes a lot of noise, but it's not particularly effective at communicating anything in particular. There's no effective atrial fluid ejection when this happens, and blood starts to pool in the atria. So we have blood flow moving through because diastolic blood pressure, the resting heart blood pressure in the vascular or venous side of the system, will continue to fill blood into the heart, and it will passively flow into the ventricles through the atria. But it will not be that extra squeeze. And so blood will kind of sit in the corners, if you can think about that. And when blood sits still, it starts to clot. So we start having clots forming in the corners of the atria, if you can picture it. And that those clots then cause their own set of problems. So we have atrial fibrillation, which is not a particularly good effective heart rhythm, that the ventricles are then contracting, pumping out less blood than they normally would. So we have a person with hemodynamic compromise risk right away. And then we throw clots into the problem, and we end up with somebody that could throw a blood clot and get a pulmonary embolism or something else. So what are we looking for? People that could be at risk for AFib. Anyone with a prior cardiac event and myocardial infarction, and this may even be one that's undiagnosed. Somebody's had a silent heart attack. Coronary heart disease, coronary artery disease history, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, CHF. Anything that's putting additional strain on the heart, causing additional risk for cardiovascular disease, is going to put you at increased risk for atrial fibrillation. And when we talk about AFib side effects, because of that inefficient cardiac ejection and the atrial pooling that occurs, we are at increased risk for pulmonary embolism, stroke, and myocardial infarction. Remember, any of those clots go out of there, they could either head out to the brain, they could head out to the lungs, they could start to head out and then get pulled back into the coronary arteries themselves and cause a blockage. And so all of these things can happen if any of those clots get kicked loose when they're pooling in the atria. And this is one of the things we have to think about when we're talking about treating AFib. So we have patients that are increased risk for syncope and hypotension because they aren't ejecting blood very well. And then we also have these other risks from blood clots. Before we get into treatment, let's look at reading the heart rhythm, regular versus irregular heart rhythms. Remember, regularity is easy to spot. It's like a clock ticking. You know, we can say the next beat's going to come this far along the strip, and it's the same all the time. You can measure it, and you can guess where the next heartbeat should be, and it will be there. That's regularity. Irregular heartbeats are a little bit different. Now, there may be an irregular heartbeat that has a pattern. It just means that it's irregular because where you expect to see a heartbeat, a ventricular contraction, you don't have one for some reason. There's something that's causing it to drop out. We see this in the heart blocks, the second and third degree heart blocks, where we have dropped heartbeats. This can occur, and there may be a pattern to it. It may be 4 beats and then a dropped beat, or 2 beats and then a dropped beat. We need to look for those patterns if it's irregular. And if there is a pattern, then it's regularly irregular. Okay, so regular irregularity is what you get when you have a pattern. And usually atrial fibrillation is not going to be regular in any way. There will be no pattern. So if you see a pattern, it's not AFib. That's one quick tip to help you diagnose, at least ruling out what different things there are. However, if there's no pattern, you have irregularity or irregularly irregular heartbeats. And you guys getting confused yet? So what we have is irregular rhythms that there's no pattern to them. We have the ventricles looking for a signal from the AV node. Come on, give me something. And the AV node's looking at the atria. And if it's in fibrillation, it's sitting there just firing randomly. And it doesn't know which to pay attention to. So the AV node just randomly passes along impulses. And those randomly passed along impulses end up sending the ventricles to fire irregularly. So we might have a beat, 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 just like that. And it's because there's no stimulus that's consistent. And so the ventricles don't know what to do, and they're just waiting for it. If they have a rapid response to the prop, to the heartbeat that they're getting, or the signals they're getting from the atria, then there could be a ventricular tachycardia or an atrial tachycardia stimulated by the atrial fibrillation. The ventricular response is rapid, and that causes even less ejection of blood from the heart because of the tachycardia, and so you can have some issues. So look for irregularity in the clue. And if we look at a strip, you can look and see maybe that sawtooth, that upside down. If you turn the strip upside down, you might have a dull old saw. An atrial flutter, those peaks are sharp, and it looks like it's a brand new saw blade. But this is going to be dull and rounded curves and irregular, and the heartbeats are going to occur, the ventricular beats are going to occur at irregular intervals. So what do we do to treat AFib? Well, we want to keep in mind that, yeah, okay, we can electrically cardiovert these people. We can even cardiovert them with some pharmacological solution like using diltiazem or amiodarone. But we should consider cardioversion only if the patient is showing signs of hemodynamic compromise. And that's because we don't want to kick those clots loose. So here we have the atria. They're sitting there. They're minding their own business, not doing anything constructive. And we've got blood pooling and clots forming in the corners. And we come along, and we get in there, and we jumpstart it. And suddenly, we get a coordinated sinus rhythm. Well, it just squeezes all of the blood and the clots out into the ventricles and into the lungs and the systemic circulation. And so we can get some, we can cardiovert them. They're now out of AFib, and they stroke out and die. We don't want to cause that. So we're only going to consider cardioversion if there's signs of hemodynamic compromise. They are extremely hypotensive. They are diaphoretic, short of breath, altered mental status. One person taught me a long time ago, you shouldn't be cardioverting someone if they would mind it. What does that mean? It means if they're alert enough to complain when you shock them, try some other route. Save the electrical cardioversion for those patients that are in severe distress. Keep in mind, you know, get your medical control involved, follow your own protocols, but that's my take on this. However, you can consider some kind of pharmacological solution, such as diltiazem or amiodarone, according to your protocols. And that may convert the atrial fibrillation, or at least slow it down enough that you can have a better ventricular response. Again, you have to be careful because we don't want to kick clots loose. So if the patient is showing signs of AFib, but they're talking to you and they're seeming fine and they're not very short of breath and you can get them to the hospital, get them there. Because the preferred treatment is to treat them with anticoagulants. We want to get heparin in there initially and then Coumadin. We want to monitor our lab values. And when they get dialed in on the anticoagulants, then we can start them on their cardioverting solution and get them into a regular treatment plan where they're taking their calcium channel blocker or beta blocker on a regular basis, and this will allow them to then maintain and manage their AFib. We want to control rate with beta or calcium channel blockers, or they may take digitalis. We don't see dig too often anymore because of the side effects associated with it, but you can find patients that are taking dig, and it's inexpensive and relatively effective if you can manage them for side effects. So you may see patients taking these medications for AFib. You want to make sure you ask them when they took their meds last. Maybe they skipped their meds and that's why they're suddenly in AFib. If onset is relatively recent, you may get permission to give them a dose of calcium channel blocker or amiodarone prior to getting them to the hospital, even if they aren't showing immediate signs of compromise. Remember that a regular rhythm may not return. If AFib is not recognized and treated quickly, the longer a person has AFib before it's treated and managed, the less likely they'll return to any kind of regular rhythm. In other words, they'll just be a person who lives with AFib. They'll be managed by medications, but they'll always show up with AFib in their ECG, and it'll just be a question of whether it's being treated and managed properly or whether it needs to be cardioverted. Let's review real quick. We want to recognize AFib. We want to determine the priority for our patient's treatment. Are they compromised? We want to, if not, provide transport and palliative care, oxygen, IV, monitor, and keep track of how they're doing, reassess them frequently, and be prepared for any side effects from the AFib, a stroke, a pulmonary embolism, or a sudden onset of heart attack or cardiac arrest. These are some of the additional references I provided for you in the show notes. Go ahead and check these out. There's a lot of good information out there on different cardiac rhythms. And remember, you can find more at Medicast Extra. This has been a Medicast Extra podcast production, and I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. You can find more over at MedicastExtra.com. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to head over to the MedicCast website at medicast.com/blog, where you'll be able to find all of the information that has been covered in this episode. So the news items, the information on atrial fibrillation and all that, additional resources that you can check into to follow up on what I talk about. Remember, you know, I could say a lot of things and I could say the sky is green, but it's your job to make sure that you realize, wait a minute, Jamie, the sky is blue where I live. So that's what I'm trying to say here is I may be making a mistake. I may misspeak some way. I may be talking about something that are in my protocols that are not allowed in your protocols. Whatever the case may be, follow your own protocols, follow your own instruction, follow your own medical direction at all times. Just because Jamie says it doesn't make it right. You can get back in touch with me and let me know that I said something wrong by sending those emails into podmedic@mac.com with suggestions, comments, links to news articles you'd like me to take a look at. All of that can be found and sent to me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also get in touch with me on the social media realm by catching up with me at facebook.com/podmedic and twitter.com/podmedic. And of course, you can always catch up with the MedicCast fan page. And that is available for you over at facebook.com/mediccast. Click the like button if you haven't already done so. And if you're already a fan of the show, head over there and comment, share some ideas back with some of the other listeners and see if you can get a conversation going about one of the articles that gets posted over there on the Facebook page. That's it for me. I'm going to be back soon with another episode. I do want to make sure you all know that we're going to be at EMS World Expo coming up here in New Orleans at the end of October. So I think it begins on Halloween Day, October 31st. And you can find out more information, go to emsworldexpo.com and follow up on that. We're going to have the live podcast studio there as well as a social media lounge with free Wi-Fi and a place to charge your devices. So you can come by, sit down in the social media lounge, listen to some live shows from the MedicCast, EMS Garage, EMS Educast, and a bunch of other great shows. And relax a little bit while you're touring the exhibit hall floor. And again, thanks to EMS World Expo for having us back in to cover their event. It's a lot of fun and we're already looking forward to it. So you want to find out more information, go to emsworldexpo.com. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Be back soon. In the meantime, I want to remind all of you to remember scene safety, BSI.